The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
Good morning, everyone. I was speaking earlier about the importance in our path, in our training, of these regularly occurring aspects of training, like Sesshin, like Ango. There's a reason why they have come down to us over many hundreds of years, the reason why they came into being in the first place and then continued, were passed down, were considered important enough, significant enough to keep alive. And because ours is a practice tradition, as practitioners, you know, to be a student is a verb. It's something we are doing. It's not something we are as an identity. To come together is not about creating a group, a club that we belong to and others do not belong to. That's not what this is about. We come together in the Dharma. We come together to study. We come together in dukkha. We come together in a burning house and in our own particular recognition of the state of things, internally and externally. We come seeking. It's a living thing. And with the regularness of our training, every day we sit, we do liturgy, we do sessions, we do ango, and there are practices that hold those. So there's a particular entering, a way of entering. There are certain words that are spoken. And I was saying to Sancho this weekend that as part of Shuso training, chief disciple training, there are words that are given to the student. And that the practice of the student is make them real, make them alive. That it's not just saying words that have been given to that person by someone else, but it's actually to get inside of what those words are saying and feel them and bring that out. And so part of a really essential part of our responsibility as practitioners, a verb, is not just that we do this, but that we do it in a way that is vital and vibrant. And as Dada Roshi said, a spiritual imperative. It's not something that we do casually in the sense of I could or I couldn't, I might or I might not, if it's convenient, if it's not. One can engage in that way. In beginning this ango again today for the first time and having done this over these many 42 years, we do this and create a continuity. We are maintaining that continuity of tradition, which means we will have something to give those who come later, those who follow. And it also means that we, I hope, want to make this genuine. I mean, because really, if not, why bother? Right? What's the point? And that's not just a responsibility, it's a gift. Because when we do that, our lives come alive. Our lives are vibrant. Because our lives are repetitive. Right? We don't wake up and do something completely different every morning, right? Or go to work in a completely different way, or do something completely different at work. There's a regularity, right? There's a quality of regularity to our lives, which can be deadening, but it can also be comforting. It can be enlivening. And it is certainly for us a practice of beginning again and again and again. And so what that means, if we want to be inspired in the world, if we want to provide something that maybe others will be inspired by, we have to be inspired. The really important part of practice is learning, how do you inspire yourself, both internally, and how do you find inspiration around you? I hope you have ample ways. I hope you can look in almost any direction and find inspiration. Dogen said this practice period is the head and face of Buddhas and ancestors. It has been intimately transmitted as their skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. It has come down to us, right? We have received this, and in a sense, we then now have that sacred responsibility to hold this well. From top to bottom, the practice period is Buddha ancestors. It covers everything, without an inch of land or a speck of earth left out. When we practice that way, when the way we practice is all-inclusive of our life, of each moment, of the high and low, of the good and the bad, of the desired and the undesired, then it's not separate from anything. We're not separated sacred from worldly, Dharma from what's not Dharma. And what happens is we're living a life that we're, I hope, actively seeking, which is a whole integrated life in the Dharma. And so Dogen says, this being so, to experience a practice period, Ango, is to experience all Buddhas and ancestors. Not just what those before us have done, sitting on this seat, speaking these words, entering, offering incense, making commitments, but also that we're meeting the mind, the body, the wholeheartedness that has come down to us, right? I mean, you don't have to go very far in reading the teachings of past masters to realize how these people were alive. And so to become fully immersed in the liveliness of the practice period, Dogen says, is to be free of the liveliness of the practice period. When you grasp for the origination of the 90-day period, it immediately appears. When you search for the cause of Ango, it's immediately right here. And so to be fully immersed in the liveliness of this Ango is to be free of the liveliness. In other words, how do we practice wholeheartedly without attachment, without clinging, without grasping, without binding, right? If we want to practice in a way that frees ourselves, we need to be freeing ourselves all along the way. And so far, if our enthusiasm or our commitment or our sincerity or our dedication becomes bound by attachment, by clinging, then it's no longer freeing us. You know, before, during, and after Angos, I and the training staff hears a lot from people, well, a lot, hears from students about, you know, making a strong commitment for Ango, being all fired up and ready to go, and then beginning, and then there's life, right, that shows up in unexpected ways, presents you with things you hadn't anticipated, or it's just you have a big appetite and you set yourself a large meal and now you're realizing, oh, how do I do all of this within all of this? And so how that can lead to discouragement, frustration, a sense of failure, that is not what the intention of Ango is unless you use that. You use that to see what is happening. The success and failure is not in you, it's not in Ango, right? That there is some grasping, there is some clinging. Then it can be useful. And then we work through it. And so there is a really important tension or dynamic in Ango, which is a commitment, right? That's why we present a form. I wish we could find some other way of doing it, right? Every time I hear that word commitment form, it's like, But it has a usefulness because it makes things clear, because we need to make things clear, right? Because if we just say, I mean, the Buddha could have just said, you know, after his enlightenment, forget the self. That's it. And the students would have been like, how? Where? When? What do I do? And so, Anga is like that, right? So we lay out our training, the gates, the different things that we're going to be engaged in, so we can study and reflect on how am I going to actually, actively engage? What am I going to do each day? Not so to nail it down, but so there's a clarity, right, about how I am going to practice. And so there's that sense of commitment, and then there's flexibility. Because if there's just commitment, that can become very rigid. And then when things need to move a little bit in order to actually practice the Ango, we're not able to do that. And something's going to break. On the other hand, if we're too flexible, then there may be little practice. Like if we're constantly accommodating ourselves to everything that comes along, there's no commitment, then we may not actually be practicing. And so, like everything we do, Anga is a practice. It's something we learn how to do by doing it and finding our way. And so each time Anga comes around, we have the opportunity to learn more, learn from past experiences, what worked, what didn't work, what helped me, what wasn't particularly helpful. In the fascicle that we're studying by Master Dogen, the moon, from which we have the theme, moon thusness. Dogen says, quoting the Buddha, Buddha's true Dharma body, as it is open sky. In response to things, forms appear. Thus is the moon and water. And I spoke earlier and said I want to work with that phrase, which happens very early in the fascicle, particularly in the Anga intensive, which will happen later in the season. Because, as I said before, these three lines holds the whole, has much to offer. He goes on to say, the thusness of thus is the moon in water. The thusness of thus is the moon in water. I'm sorry. The thusness of thus is the moon in water is moon in water. I left out quotation marks, so grammar counts. It is water thusness, moon thusness, thusness within thusness. Thus does not mean like something, thus means exactly. And this really is the heart of what Buddha Dharma is teaching, what practice is, what liberation is practicing in accord with thusness, which is the nature of things as they are. Thusness isn't like something, it means exactly. It means the thing itself. And so the theme of moon thusness is the study of reality, the study of this body and mind, the study of our life, the study of our world as it is. And when those things appear with difficulty, with pain, with confusion, when they appear as hatred, when they appear as conflict, it's hard, right? It's difficult to face that because it affects us, right? We are affected, we are sentient beings. And so as bodhisattvas, the challenge is always, how do we turn towards and face something as it is, without projecting what it should be, what we want it to be, what it will be when we get fully in control of it. And allow ourselves to experience that pain, that confusion, that anger, without creating more, but with insufficient closeness so that we can see it clearly and transform it, liberate it. And so thinking of thusness, our theme, as experiencing things as they are, and then thinking of that as the medicine that has always been the medicine of Buddhism, But particularly in our time, right? Because this is our time. And it's a time of illusions. Now, from a Buddhist perspective, we're always living in illusions, right? That our mind creates images and ideas and patterns and doesn't see itself creating those. We just experience the world, we think, objectively, because we're not able to always see clearly how our mind is actively creating. And so the Buddha said the three worlds are mind. But in our time, beyond just the way our minds, in a condition, deluded sense, do that, we live in a time that manufactures illusions. It has become very smart, very brilliant, and very profitable at creating illusions. Advertising, media, internet, fake news, disinformation, heated debates about important issues where expert opinions about are given, and sometimes people are talking about things that they really don't know much about. I think of critical race theory as a good example. How many people are talking about and couldn't actually tell you what that actually means? What does that actually mean? A time where rightful attempts to begin to teach a truer, more complete history is under threat, like literally being criminalized. The Buddha said we live in a moral universe as human beings. We create good and bad all over the place. And in all shades of the spectrum, from mildly good to sublimely good, from mildly bad to horrendously bad. That's how powerful we are. And so our path is a moral path, because the Buddha said there is no other way to awakening. There is no other way to liberation except to live a moral path, which in Buddhism doesn't just mean following rules, precepts. That's not what the precepts are. It means to live in accord like every other aspect of the universe, to live in accord with the world that we are actually in, like every other living creature and every inanimate creature, but for us. And we have to work very hard, actually, to do that, which is his own puzzle. But the Buddha was very clear that if we don't do that, then everything else that we do is just not going to, it's not going to work. It's not going to be what we want it to be. And so in the midst of all of these illusions, these manufactured delusions, and all of the hatred and conflict and violence and anger and non-functionality, there is right speech. There's actually right speech, speaking truthfully, speaking with kindness to bring us together. You know, in the quote that Gokhan read of Master Dogen, and the emphasis that Dogen places on peaceful dwelling, that peaceful dwelling includes, as practitioners, your anger. It includes your judging mind, your harsh mind, your petty mind, your critical mind, whether you turn it towards yourself or others. It has to, because we have that. We have all that stuff, right? And so don't hear that as saying that you have to somehow extinguish or suppress those aspects of yourself that arise that in the moment don't seem particularly peaceful. That's how we practice peaceful dwelling, is in such moments. And we learn how to do that together, and how to hold those eruptions, small and large, as a Sangha. In the Abhidhammasaka Sutra, the Buddha said, actually it was Maitreya, I think was the spokesperson, said that bodhisattvas do not shrink from existence in any world. They don't shrink from existing, from being, in whatever world they find themselves in. They're not afraid to live in the time that they've been given. That's the time they've been given. So in a sense, that's the time that we should try and choose, right? Not just sort of live now because that's, we got that by default, but actually say, no, this is the time I want to be living in. What can I do? How can I help? Because this time needs help. Padmasambhava said that your mind is as vast as the sky, unbounded, limitless. And that's your self nature, and it's the nature of every living thing. And he said, now, keep your actions fine as flour. So to recognize that our basic nature and the nature of everyone is large and boundless. Delusion is constantly trying to confine and restrict every form of bias and prejudice and discrimination and oppression is based in that constriction and the solidifying of lies, deceptions, falsehoods that are attributed to vast, boundless beings. And in recognizing that's our nature, that's the nature of everyone. Now, how do we live in what we might call right relationship? Think of right in the sense of the Eightfold Path. And right here isn't so much right and wrong, but right means living in accord with this, with the world, with nature, with our nature. That is peaceful dwelling. And so it's to be aware, mindful, and attentive to our actions and their consequences as fine as flour. And that's why we have to practice. That's why Dogen said, sit the 90-day training period. Because Zazen is unparalleled, I believe, in giving us that clear, bright window into that vast as sky mind and into the need for being so attentive to our actions. And not in a hyper-vigilant, fussy, overwrought kind of way, naturally. And so Dogen says, to be able to grab hold of this spirit, to practice this way, to live this way, we have to train. He says, train constantly for 30 years. I don't know why I limited it to 30 years. But we can start with that. And then when you get to 30, add another 30. How? By eating meals, sleeping, stretching your legs. And that requires unstinting support. That is to just live, to be in every moment, in every simple, ordinary moment, and in moments when you are called forth. And you think, I am not the person for this, but you are the one who is called. Or you call yourself forward. And he says, that unstinting support is the structure of the 90-day practice period. Well, how nice. Here we are. It has been intimately transmitted as the Buddha's skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. We do require that support. Each of us has everything we need to do, as the Buddha said, what must be done. And in order to bring that out, to blossom like a flower, Sancho's name means mountain bloom. Excellent name. We need support for that. We need help, just like the flower needs help, right? It doesn't do that on its own. There's this vast web working together so that we can be that Buddha, that Bodhisattva, generous, boundless, and as fine as flour in the moment. And so our Zazen, on and off the cushion. And I really encourage all of us to really emphasize the off-the-cushion practice. It's just so easy to get lost in familiar actions, routines, and so on, to get lost in just motion, just activity, to get lost in conversations, to get lost in mental thought, And so it requires a considerable effort. It does, right? Because up to practice, we weren't probably giving that much attention, which means we were training ourselves deeply and consistently in a ongoing state of relative distractedness. And so Zazen is the core. Our studies will be studying this fascicle, the moon, which is beautiful, wonderful. And I encourage you to really study it, to read it, to chant it, to take small sections and just read and then reflect, stop and reflect. That's what we'll be taking up in the mandos. The first one is coming up this week, where we'll do them, look at the fascicle in sections. We'll also be bringing in other teachings, the Theragatha, the teachings of some of the original Buddha's nuns, disciples, their teachings, some of the passages in the connected discourses of the Buddha, where Mara was visiting different of the practicing nuns of the Buddha and trying to disrupt them, trying to mess them up, mess up their practice, right? Mara is ourselves, messing up ourselves, right? It's that self-saboteur that knows you so well and knows just how to wiggle right in and get to that soft, vulnerable spot. There's some really wonderful teachings there. And also included some passages from the book Time to Stand Up by Thanissara, who was a nun for many years and has really devoted herself to climate action and has some really good things to say about being a bodhisattva and particularly bringing in the feminine principle, that aspect of the moon. In our practice, Hojin Sensei introduced it with this phrase from Master Hongzhi: in clarity, wonder exists, with spiritual energy shining on its own. And then she guides us to take, in the Buddha's, in the Dogen's, this fascicle where he talks about the Buddha's true Dharma body, I wanted to really sort of use that to focus on the bodies of the 10,000 things, the bodies of humanity, right? Of all the other than human beings, of the inanimate world, that everything that appears, we could say, appears within a body, a form. And that each of these appears in response to things, which we will be causes and conditions, we'll be getting into later more, in thusness, in its perfect original state, and is nothing other than the nature of Buddha. When we don't understand that those bodies are the body of Buddha, are vast and boundless, are free of any discrimination, any flaw, then when we don't see them that way, then that inevitably will lead to false views because we're not seeing it clearly, so we will necessarily have other perceptions, other views that are not in accord, that are not peaceful dwelling. We are not seeing that body as a true body of the Buddha. And that becomes the basis of our attachments and the creation of suffering. And we live in a time that is an all too vivid testimony to how this works out. Because there is no conflict except between bodies, right? Right relationship, if we think of that as part of the Eightfold Path, which in a sense is the whole project, is the relationship between all of the many bodies of the world. And that means you and me in all of our differences. It means me and everything that I see arise within myself, every thought, every sensation, every emotion. It means every inanimate being, whether it be a building or a bridge or a car or a computer or a tree or a mountain. And it's in those relationships that the house is burning. That's the place that the Bodhisattva, the Avatamsaka says, is not afraid of. Which means we have to keep entering into that very place we call relationship, which is much too small a word to hold all that that is. And so when we think about our world of black, brown, and white bodies, of female, male, and non-binary bodies, of young and old bodies, rich and poor, red and blue, north and south, human beings and other creatures, the mountains and rivers, clouds and rains, bridges, buildings, streets, stores. It's a long, long inventory. If we want to free ourselves, we free ourselves in every relationship. And what the Buddha realized is that the fundamental relationship that each of us has is with ourselves. You are headquarters, central, right? You are the vault. You are the sun and the moon. You are the universe, basically, from which everything else is going to come forth. And so the Buddha said, if we don't get that in order, which he said you do with your moral sense, your moral compass, your moral living, with the calming of the kleshas, all of the tumultuous waves that arise within us in every form, and then those false views. Those views that we have of what the world is, how it works, who you are, when I look out on the world and see you, and whoever that you happens to be in that moment. Because everything that I think and everything that I say and everything I do is coming right out of that. And when that's muddy, this is muddy. And that's where we are either serving and healing and giving benefit to and enlivening each other, or we're doing other things. You know, living in our time where spiritual practice, spirituality is so prevalent in, you know, the internet and magazines and books and so on, and talking ideas, you know, on the one hand, we can just think of it as a kind of glossy, nice, pleasant, a good thing to have in our lives, right? Have a little spirituality. Have a little compassion. That sounds like a good thing. I'd like a little of that. And in that way, it is whatever we make it. And so when Dadarushi used to speak about a spiritual imperative, that really made an impression, as you can tell, because I still invoke that, the imperative aspect. Because in thinking another way, we can think of this as sort of, you know, expendable, something we can do if we have time. It'd be a good idea, but, you know, there's all this other stuff that I got to get to. And we do. That's the thing. And to free ourselves of that, of the dualistic way of thinking is that, okay, now what's more important? That's how things get pushed aside. The Bodhisattva says, it's all important, and important differently. It's all important, but it's important differently. And so how the emphasis we give to certain things means recognizing there are certain things that are important in a way that they should not be forgotten. And that's mirrored in what we do in our practice, right? And so like during Sesshin, there are certain forms of practice that are important, but we let go of, to bring forth other forms of practice that are important and we want to give particular emphasis to because they actually have a greater significance in terms of what they allow us to do. And so on the one hand, there's that sense of imperative, but so that that doesn't get too somber, severe. Like, it's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. Right? There is compassion. There is loving kindness. There is joy. And that doesn't mean that we are happy in every moment or we feel joyful in every moment, but that we are actually cultivating that. And that's important. It's not just like, you know, an after-dinner mint. You know, if you go to a particularly nice restaurant, I don't know, it's probably different if you go to a really nice restaurant, something that's really special. It's not like that. It's the main course. That's something I've always appreciated about the Dharma. It's always appreciated about what I experienced when I first came here, that there were moments where it was like, it was serious. And it helped me to be serious and realize, oh, wait a minute, I'm in the middle of something. My life. And it's passing. And it matters. So I don't want to get lost in that. And then in the next moment, it was joyful. And simple, and easy, and light. And I remember being particularly aware of that in the beginning, because it kept kind of, you know, like I couldn't just grab on and say, okay, this is what it is. It's all of this. And I think that's important in entering into the Sangha, that we have that sense, right, of both the importance, because, you know, our world's in a bit of a jam. And it needs practitioners of all stripes and faiths and paths. I don't really care how you get there. Just get there. It doesn't matter to me that much what the tools, the skillful means that a person uses to bring forth wisdom and compassion. Just bring them forth, please. Or by what ways we diminish and let go of adding more confusion and more chaos to the world. Whatever you do that actually works, do that. And so we are beginning this 3-month training period, moon thusness, taking up these many bodies of the Buddha appearing in all of their various forms. You know, and what happens for the Bodhisattva as we practice and we shed and see through and liberate ourselves from all of the dampening. I mean, that's what the self does. It just dampens. It's like a veil is one of the images that's used. It's like a shroud. It's like a blanket. It's like a hot, steaming, wet blanket on a hot, sultry day. Yeah, exactly. You know it exactly, right? That's what it's like. And when that's lifted, right? And what we see then is that the world and all of those bodies are actually quite beautiful. And we are can be so easily inspired by that. And so let us go forth, come in to the Sangha together. We will, Sancho, I want to just mention, forgot you were sitting over there. Mountain Bloom has been practicing here for many years, entered as a student in 2001, and did Jikai, receiving his Dharma name with Dada Roshi in 2004, and studied with Roshi for all of those years, and then became my student when Roshi passed, has spent considerable amount of time in residency, in periods of extended residency. He is our current bee master, tending to our winged ones who create the nectar that we enjoy, pollinating the flowers that we depend upon. And also, a lot of people didn't know, but I think is noteworthy, is that some years ago I went to Sancho and I said, you know, there's no reason. For years we were buying our candles from a company out in California. And believe it or not, I couldn't find any other company like on the East Coast, who made these kinds of candles. They were either way too big or too small, they just didn't work. And we just paid an enormous amount in shipping, it just seemed crazy. And so I went to Sancho and I said all of that, and I said, could you figure out a way to make candles? We should be able to make our own candles. And that started a whole sort of scientist in the lab process. It was harder than you think. And he did all, it was like alchemy. He did all of these different, because it was, there's, you know, we were trying to get away from paraffin, and there's beeswax, and there's soy, you were using soy, and all these different ingredients. And, but to get a candle that actually was just right, right? And then burned nice and clean and didn't drip. And that took quite a while.
5 years.
5 years? Longer than I thought. But now, look at what we have, these beautiful candles. So he's been busy, right? All of these years. And we'll be very busy over these 3 months, providing an example. And for us here, we're very fortunate because Sancho lives locally, and so he'll be able to spend a lot of time here. He already does. He's here quite a bit every week. But so that's just another gift. And the Shuso, remember, it provides an example. And the Shuso, sometimes people wonder, how is this person selected by the teacher? And it has to do with Dharma understanding and developing that in a way that is developing nicely. And it also has to do with how a person is living their practice, how they are in relationship to the Sangha. To me, it's very important. To the teachers, it's very important that they're also actively engaged in our Beyond Fear of Differences work, that they're actively within themselves and within the Sangha, healing these historical wounds of racism and sexism and misogyny and all the forms, homophobia, all the forms of transphobia, all the forms of bias that are active and that we have inherited in our different bodies. And so Sancho is a good embodiment of all of that. And in becoming a senior student, they're also a student. All of us, first and foremost, are students of the Dharma. That's the way I feel, that a teacher, their first and primary responsibility is to continue to be a student of the Dharma. Everything else will come from that. When that is kept on track, when that is taken care of, then everything else, and it's not that it'll happen automatically, but then we have that very, the basis of what this is. Right, from which to navigate. Which is another way of saying that we are all bodhisattvas in the path, right? And so that being a senior student means being a student. So no one here is, I mean, it seems like trivial or unnecessary to even say, but it's not actually, is that no one here is perfect. You know, we have these ideas that we create about perfection, that we apply to ourselves and create a lot of misery for ourselves, and we apply to others and create misery for others. And it's fake news, right? It doesn't exist, except in the sense that it's used in the Dharma, that things abiding in their own state are perfect. And because we do not always conduct ourselves as fine as flour, sometimes we make missteps. We say things, we do things that are hurtful. And so then we practice that, right? We can do that. We know how to do that. And so it's just important to say that again, right? That's part of how we can actually do this. Because if we hold unrealistic expectations upon each other, then it's not real, right? We're trying to create something that isn't Buddha Dharma. It isn't us, and it's not going to serve. Dogen, in a poem, said, "In the heart of the night, the moonlight framing, a small boat drifting, tossed not by the waves, nor swayed by the breeze." And so let's go forward thinking of that image of this small boat crossing over Prajnaparamita, lit in the moonlight, on the waves, in the breeze, but not moving in accord, not tossed, not disrupted, learning how to move in accord. And then finally, I wanted to end with a poem by Rengetsu, the well-known Buddhist nun and teacher and poet, artist. In a mountain field, enthralled, so enthralled, returning all the way home, accompanied by the autumn moon. And so let's think of traveling this whole 3 months in such a way, enthralled, enthralled, all the way home, accompanied by the autumn moon.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.